Well, the world is dumpster fire, and nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good, and you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And today on the show, Juneteenth, as a matter of fact, what better way to celebrate Black excellence in America than by talking to the amazing Tanya McKenzie. She took time out of her very busy book tour schedule to talk to us, to talk to you, all about her very, very wild story, which you can read currently in her book, A Child's Memories of Cartoons and Murder. This is a really great conversation, and we cover some of what's in the book. But her story is too big for an hour conversation to contain. And I think you'll get that as we have the conversation. And I'm going to get us into it. I'm going to get us into it quick because it's a great, great conversation. And we don't need to listen to me talk too much about too much of anything. But I did want to give a little bit of an update on the emotional weather report at the moment. I just wanted to say that if you're like me, there are times when your depression kicks in and it gets the better of you and it seems to want to take over the conversation in every area of your life. And there are times where you should be feeling joy and you're just not. There are times when your depression can be kicked into a high gear by feelings of sadness or hopelessness, by things that you hear from loved ones, bad news that you get, paying attention to what's happening in the world can sometimes be too much, and it can exacerbate an already existing problem and make you feel lower than normal. And there's a tendency in this time period to focus on how awful it feels right now, because it feels like an immediate threat. But you've got to zoom out and take a look at the big picture. Because if you're like me, or even if you're like you, the probability that this is a time in your life and a phase in your feelings that will have its moment and will feel absolutely terrible. Maybe the most terrible you'll ever feel. And it will pass, as all things pass. So as you're feeling it, acknowledge it, accept it, understand that this is part of you, part of your journey as a human being. And I hate to say that sadness, pain, loneliness, confusion are all teachers, but they are if you decide to be a student. If you really want to unpack all of those things, there's a lot to be learned about how you can manage yourself when those things come, because you will not have a life free of pain, free of sadness. No one can. It is a fact of our existence. The good news is our existence also comes with love, joy, celebration, excitement, anticipation. There are so many wonderful, wonderful feelings that we also get to experience. It just so happens that sometimes you don't get to have those. Sometimes it's absolutely not fair. What the world is doing, what someone you know is doing, what a stranger is doing. Sometimes there are situations thrust upon us as human beings that we didn't ask for and we don't deserve. And if we're very lucky, we live through those things to celebrate another day. Because there will be another day. All right, so that's the emotional weather report for today. We're not going to get into anything else. I'm not going to waste your time rambling on and on about other things. I'm just going to say, if you're feeling rough like I'm feeling rough, I hope you take a moment to recognize that every moment passes and is an opportunity for something else to come next. And if you wait it out through enough moments, you're going to get a great one eventually. The odds are in your favor. Believe that. All right, enough of that. Let's get into this really meaty conversation. Let's talk to Tanya McKenzie. Let's just start here. Hi, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. It's, not to put a timestamp on this, but I'm all over the place with everything that's going on currently in the country. It's a very, very strange time to be alive as a human being.
It's one of those moments where if something's funny, you're almost scared to laugh. If you cry, you're scared you might not stop. It is kind of awkward right now. Yes.
Yeah.
I'd agree.
Well, normally the way that I start these conversations with people is I will kind of take things back to the beginning of someone's life, leading up to what led them to the moment of trauma or recognition or something like that changed them or that caused them a great difficulty that they had to overcome, to provide some context for how our experiences shape us as human beings. But with your story, I can't do that because your story begins at an incredibly young age. So I'd like to do something a little different. Why don't you tell me who you are and where you are currently, and then let's go back.
Well, that's the fun part, because I'm actually in a pretty good space.
Yeah.
Even with everything going on in life. And I do think that those young experiences helped me to be prepared to be in a space like this, which can be so awkward.
Yeah.
I'm in Southern California now. I am from the Bay Area. So I'm from Northern California. I went to California State University, Northridge. But even before I went to Northridge, I went to Grambling State University, an all-Black college, because I felt like I just needed a little culture, you know. Being blessed enough to be from California, you experience a lot of multiculturalism, and it's to the benefit of many of us. We're kind of spoiled, right? So a lot of what's going on, we are underexposed to that. We're so used to just being one big rainbow of people. Went to Grambling University down south. From California. That was really hard. The bugs were really big, and I couldn't get out of there fast enough. So I went to Cal State Northridge in Los Angeles, which was in the Valley, where the Rodney King incident happened, if you remember that.
Oh, I do.
And also, it was right after the big earthquake that actually shook the university. So I got there while the school was actually in rumble. So my first classes were in bungalows. And it was at a time of rebuilding, but it was an amazing experience. So Cal State Northridge taught me a lot. I was an RA there, and I used to take care of the residents from the overflow. So, you know, there's dorms where there's athletes, there's older students. I had the overflow. I had the multicultural, the don't speak English, the vegetarians, the hippies. I had them all. So those were my residents, and I had to learn as a college student to take care of those people and actually make it a community, hence preparing for the world to fall apart like it is right now. All that being said, after Northridge, moved back to the Bay Area because my mom passed away in 99, right after my graduation. I had two little sisters, 5 and 7 at the time. So me and my fiance at the time, he went to San Diego State, moved back to the Bay Area. He was in tech. I have always been in advertising, marketing, PR. And after 13 years, another tech firm moved us back to Southern California. We live in Redondo Beach. We have 4 amazing kids. One plays basketball for Sarah Lawrence College. And I have a set of twins. Like, who does that? That's a whole other story. we live in Redondo Beach, California. I'm incredibly active with the community here. I run my PR firm, and life is pretty good. You know, we don't have a lot of complaints. We go through the day-to-day struggles, money decisions. Do I want to choke my kids out or let them live? I mean, you know, the day-to-day type thing.
Exactly.
But for the most part, everybody lives to fight another day in this house, and they seem pretty happy. So I would say we're doing an okay job as parents. I don't know. You'd have to meet them.
You know, it's one of those things where I've had this idea that it's really not a matter of whether or not you're going to fuck up your kids. It's kind of a matter of how. So
absolutely,
it's just damage control after a certain point, because as parents, I'm a parent. I have 3 kids, and they are all so vastly different, and there are definitely signs every now and again of areas where I was trying to do something helpful, and clearly it created some kind of psychosis.
Listen, I have twins that are nothing alike, okay? They don't look alike. They don't act alike. You get to see, because they're boy and girl twins.
Yeah.
Exactly how much faster, I'm not trying to be rude, women mature faster than men, like in real time.
Yeah.
Like, who walks faster? Who picks up on real life situations? Who's the problem solver? And who's the boy that knows how to take advantage of women's kindness with his cute smile? I mean, these are things that they learn at an early age.
Yeah. There's a reinforcement to a lot of those things too. Do you think that there's any sort of validity to the idea that women mature faster socially because they're required to?
I do, more or less, also because of the things that I've been through and been able to see how I handle situations, and then also maybe how my son handles certain situations at that age, right? So just really being cognizant of how decisions are made, it is very, you know, there's a truth to the nurturing aspect of it too, right?
Sure.
There are, women are natural nurturers. And I watched it even as my daughter was like 3 years old, barely walking, but when her dad comes home from work, she done took the remote from my side of the bed and put it on his side of the bed like dad's coming home. Like, I'm watching it and I'm not going to say anything because I really want to see how this all plays out. And they do this whole, oh my God, and love, love. And I was like, did she just do that? Like, did she? She goes so far, by the time she was five, she was turning it to ESPN. So by the time he comes home, not only does he have the remote, it's on the channel he wants to. And I was like, who does that? Like, it's not something you teach.
Yeah.
They watch. They're observant. And everybody plays a particular role. And some, it's just, they're born like that. We even watch to see how they take on our characteristics, right?
Yeah.
And then there are days when they take on all of our characteristics and I want to move out. So it's really just an interesting thing to watch kids and what they pick up on and what they are naturally bred to do. Yeah, girls are, they mature faster.
Well, I think that there's not really a way to dance around this too much. I think we've gotta go back. I'm very confused or conflicted rather about how to even delve into and crack open a story like yours. So if you could, can you take me back to where you were in your childhood when this whole thing started?
So the person I am now is a gun violence sexual assault survivor. Mm-hmm. When I was 4.5 years old, my mother was a single mom looking for love. You know, my mom loved love. Her and my dad were married, even though he has 11 kids. I'm the only woman child that he was actually married to. So he married my mom, the only one out of all the women. And they lived with my mother, which was also around the corner from my great-grandmother.
Yeah.
So they stayed married for a few minutes because he realized this is a woman-dominated household and I cannot be who I want to be in this house, in this family. And he just bounced, and my mom loves love and she was always looking for love, but she liked bad boys. And all of this, you know, are things that I've actually found out as I was writing my book, because I, into my adulthood, was very confused about so many things. So with that, her boyfriend at the time had spent the night at the house, and his son was there, and they were in the room, and we were in the living room, and, you know, Saturday morning cartoons is what we love. Got ready, Schoolhouse Rock and Pac-Man cartoons. Don't want to put a timestamp on it, as you said, but, you know, the Smurfs were a big deal back then. So
yeah.
On Saturday morning, we would get up and make cereal and lay in the bed and watch TV. And there was a knock at the door. And I recognized one of the faces, which was my uncle. But I knew that I could not open the door because my mother would have broken my neck. So I called her out. She came out to answer the door. And before I could even lift my head up, there was shooting. And she had ran back into the room. She was in her robe. Next thing I know, we were looking at her on the floor in front of us. She had been shot. They had shot her boyfriend in the bedroom, and then they rushed out. Eventually, the ambulance came. One of her cousins who lived in that building came and got me, took me to my grandmother's house, and she went off in the ambulance, and that was the last time I had seen her for months. So as far as I knew, she had died. because I saw her in the ambulance. No one ever talked about it. I went to school. That was Saturday. I went to school on Monday. And that was it for a very long time.
Wow.
So 4 and a half, I think that was preschool. I was in kindergarten. Miss Courtney was her name. My teacher, she was amazing. Someone came in my class, these nice gentlemen in suits, and they took me out of my classroom, took me to the airport, and put me on an airplane, and I sat right next to my mother. Had not seen her since the moment she had been shot. No one talked to me about it. We were whisked off to New York to be in a federal witness protection program. And that was the beginning of my childhood. The rest of it was spent, you know, once the trial was over. And how do I say this? She actually did some time in a women's facility.
Yeah.
Because she perjured herself on the stand to protect the murderer.
Mm-hmm.
They found that out. But back then, they had prisons for women with children. A lot of people don't know about those or don't think they exist or only exist on TV. No, they exist in real life. And I spent time with my mother in a federal prison after we got out of witness protection. We get out of there. We move around. We wind up at my grandmother's house. We're in some shelters. We're here and there. And eventually the murderer got, you know, convicted. And it has just been a melee of back and forth and up and down. I had probably had about 20 different residence addresses before I graduated high school, and had about 100 encounters with the police by the time I was 18, none of which were my fault. But that kind of lets you know what my childhood looked like and what a struggle it was to keep your head on straight.
Yeah.
Not become a victim of your upbringing and just make different choices, you know.
Decided how much I'm sorry.
A very early age, just decided at a very early age what I didn't want to do and what I didn't want to be.
How much of what was happening was shared with you at the time? How aware were you of the realities of the situation?
Unaware. You know, you grow up in a family, particularly Black family. I don't know what it's like to grow up in a white family, so I don't know if it's the same, but we are taught you stay out of grown folks' business and you are not to talk back and you are to be seen, not heard. So when those conversations were had, of course, if I wasn't ear hustling and just being nosy, I was really left to my own vices to try to figure it out. So even, you know, with, let's say when the murder happened and I went back to school, you know, they never spoke to me about it. Like, no one ever said, oh, your mom's okay. She's in the hospital. Like, those were never conversations.
What were the conversations?
They were not. They were not had with me around. So things would just happen. And I just had to go with it. There was a lot of domestic violence. There's a lot of domestic violence, and not just the man on woman domestic violence, the, you know, brother on sister domestic violence, the uncle on niece domestic violence. So, you know, it was taught to us at an early age also, you don't talk back to somebody that can pop you in the mouth. The conversations just were not had. So I say all that to say when I got older and went off to college, I think college is an awakening for a lot of young people. It's a moment where you are away from your family. If you are able to go, you are away from your primary influences, left to learn and understand life on your own. Now, if you trust your resources, which is your family and the people back home, then you can go ahead and call them and ask these questions. But at the time, I did not. So I had to figure these things out on my own. I actually started doing some research on my own about the murder. And then I started looking at, well, I wonder what happened to him, you know, the murderer. And I started getting information from victim services because I would contact the jail to find out, like, okay, what were the actual charges? Like, I want to know the story around what happened when I was a kid. There was never anyone that stepped up and said, hey, this is what happened. So I just started doing the research myself. And then I found out there was a couple of times where he almost got released. So when I started doing the research, the Justice Department would let me know, hey, he's up for parole. And I was still so uneasy about it. I was like, I'm not ready for him to be out. I don't know who, you know, I don't know what's going on here. So they would teach me how to write letters to the Justice Department and petition for him to stay in prison. If I was feeling some level of anxiety and fear, how to get taken care of by victim services. So I started really registering and getting involved in the legal system and how it works and how it's actually set up to protect you and the different ways that you can go about making sure that you take your life in your own hands and you take control of the narrative that's going on. So that's kind of where that started. And then, you know, starting to build a life with my husband and still being involved with my family, as dysfunctional as they were, you know, as you get older, you start thinking, these are things that I went through as a kid. I don't want to have to ever explain any of this to my kids. Yeah. So the only way that I could do that was effectively to remove them from the situation because the adults in the room were not making any changes in how things went. So why would I expect them after 20, 30 years, they're not making any changes and some of these things are still happening? Well, now it's time for me to make the change in order for me to never have to explain to my children any of the things that I just don't think kids should have to be thinking about at that age.
Yeah. What is your thought process on as far as the way you were raised around family? Is it one of those things where because I find this in dysfunctional families in particular, which honestly I think are, you know, a majority maybe, but there is this underlying current that almost like family can do no wrong. There's an expected forgiveness for unspeakable behavior because they're family. Is that something that was held true for you and maybe part of a difficulty in cutting ties with toxic family members?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started realizing, even just watching things happen to my mother as I was in my early adulthood, right? And one, the word I'm sorry is not something that's utilized often in my family. Two, they would use the word to almost weaponize against your mistrust or dislike about anything that was happening. So whenever you decided to revolt against the system, which is we fight and then we hang out the next day, or I steal something from you and then we hang out or whatever, I'll just say, listen, we're family. So that was a weapon actually to make you feel bad about not being okay with being treated badly. And I was like, this is not how this is supposed to work. It didn't feel good. Like I thought, and for me personally, with my own children, I thought the word family should feel good. It should feel warm. Like yeah. You're family and you melt. I was in a place where when they would say family, I would stiffen up and it would get cold and it felt a different type of way. So I started actually having those conversations with the younger generation of my family, so the young cousins. And I remember I had an event at my home one time, and we just had cousins. I said, let's, you know, no aunties, uncles. Let's keep all the old, he did this and that to me. Let's just do the cousins. And they're like, yeah, it's going to be great. We had the best freaking time ever. It was a blast. It was the young people, the babies, the little cousins, the, you know, I would say 0 to about 35.
Yeah.
It was almost like 40 and up had so much baggage. It just never opened up to feel the kind of love that you should with family. So, you know, with that being said, that's how I started learning about generational dysfunction. This has been going on for generations.
Yeah.
So if we, the new generation, does not decide that we want different or we want better, it's going to continue to happen. And I, for one, don't feel like explaining any of that to my kids. I just don't.
Yeah.
So the only way for that to happen is to break the chain. And I'll be honest, I think the book, when I wrote the book, that was the camel, the pump that broke the camel's back. Like, that was a done deal, because you're also taught what happens in our house stays in our house. Family business stays in the house. So the moment that, you know, that was written and published and put out on Front Street for others to read, it didn't go well. It didn't go well.
I can imagine.
I was okay with that. Yeah, but, you know, I'll tell you a quick story. At my book signing, you know, there was some media there. There was a lot of people from the community. I work in mainstream America, so I have some mainstream friends. But I did have some of my cousins and aunt come from that side of the family that I had spoken on in the book. And I wasn't sure how they were going to take it. Like, we didn't get a chance to talk about it before, so I didn't know how that reception was going to be. And I'll be honest and say, I was scared to death. So I'm up here and I'm reading pieces of the book and I'm crying a little bit, and because some of it is emotional. But for the most part, I read some of the most dynamic pieces of the book. And they stood up and said, we just want to let you all know to the audience that everything she's saying is true. And we do have crazy in our family. I cried. There were people in the audience that cried because it was so powerful to say, she's not making these things up. And as crazy as they seem, they're true. But that also gave other people in the room the opportunity to be like, you know what? My family's crazy too. So it was great. It was just a moment for everybody.
Well, and that's got to be incredible to have that, to have those experiences validated, and especially by people who, when they enter the room, there's a level of anxiousness. You know, where are you going to land? Because it's not all about rational. I mean, there are a lot of times when something awful can happen in a family, and it's not a matter of the family denying that it happened. It's just a matter of them saying, yeah, but we're not going to talk about that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's taboo to talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I know this happened to you, but it's more important that we stay quiet.
You know, I even had someone say, listen, I really like how you spoke about my parents in the book, but did you really have to use real names? I was like, well, did I lie? Well, no, that's not the point. Did you have... I was like, oh my God, what are we doing right now? And the thing is, I said, yeah, I had to use real names because I am an authentic storyteller. My job is public relations and communication. So there was no reason for me to put these imaginary, fictitious names in a book that more than half of this stuff is public record. So for the murder, I didn't get to this point, but the actual murderer was my uncle. It was my mom's uncle, so my great uncle. And he apparently had a plethora of charges even before this happened. So guns, women, drugs. I don't even know if it's all through California, because this is the thing. During the book research, someone told me, which I eventually found out is true, you know, people don't go to federal witness protection for a domestic crime. So
right.
Then I had to do, you know, so that there was that whole thought pattern that I hadn't even discovered on my own. But once that was said, I'm still not done trying to find out exactly what part my mother played in this, because that was her uncle and that was her boyfriend. So then what part did she actually play in this? That was never revealed. And I've asked other people that have been like, you need to leave this alone, which definitely sets me on fire to go find out more. I don't know why these people don't understand that about me yet. But as of right now, I still don't know what that is. But why would I use fictitious names when these things are a matter of public record?
Right.
And once I did write about my uncle who assaulted me, sexually assaulted me in high school, there were other girls that I went to high school with that have come out and said, oh, you too? So if my point is to help other people by writing my story, why would I use fictitious names that can't help them, especially if this is something that has also happened to them with these individuals? It lets them know, like, you're not crazy. You didn't bring this on yourself. This is a problem for him or for his family, not for you to continue to carry. And those are all hard truths that people just do not want to hear and deal with.
And in a situation where that is the case, where do you start getting your guidance to start making some changes within yourself to try to heal these things?
You know, those are boundaries, and we all have issues and a hard time drawing boundaries with people that we love because we don't want to lose them. And, you know, we don't want them to feel like you don't love them, but it's a level of self-love. I had to learn that also. Like, having boundaries is really for you because it protects your soul. It protects your state of mind. I'll tell you this. One of the other things I learned, we were talking about parenting earlier. You know, there are some traits. I truly believe this. You can tell me if I'm wrong. There are some traits and attributes I feel like kids get from their parents. I think it's genetic. There are some behaviors that are just genetic. And one of my behaviors that I got from my mother is a high level of anger and rage when you have hurt me. And having boundaries keeps me from having to go to that uncomfortable space. I didn't like it seeing her that angry or her that livid or her in fights. And she used to fight. Like, she was a woman that had no problem going toe to toe with a man, woman, whatever. So growing up, seeing her actually have fist fights with men was difficult because it left me scared a lot of times.
Yeah.
If I know that that's something that I am capable of or that my anger can get me to that place, why would I even allow for it to go there? And I know that it's a characteristic that I don't like. So the only way for me to do that is to have boundaries that will keep me from getting to that place. And being honest about when you have done something that is taking me to that place. Like, let's not do this right now. I don't think I can handle this conversation, or I don't think I can handle this situation right now. So let me walk away and we can talk about it later, or whatever the case may be. But part of it is really acknowledging who you are as a person and then having boundaries that protect your sanity, that protect your happiness, that protect your safety.
Where does that level of emotional intelligence come from? Because I have to imagine that with everything that you experienced from a young age, that there was a level of some wiring being put in place for when this happens, I'm going to react this way. When I'm confronted with a problem, this is how I'm going to defend myself. How do you start rewiring some of those things that seemed like protection in the beginning? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I absolutely do. And I'll be honest, reaching a breaking point and seeing myself in those situations. So I have been in a state of rage, incredible amounts of rage before. Particularly when I was in college and started experiencing just heavy loads and heavy waves, just anger and not understanding why I was getting to that point. That was one, because what I did recognize, like, I didn't know why I got there, but what I did recognize that I didn't like it.
Yeah.
I don't like feeling like this. I don't care what the result is. I don't care who loses, who wins, you know, I cuss them out, we fight, whatever. I don't like that feeling. But the real high level of emotional intelligence came when my husband and I really started tapping into what happiness looked like. I'll give you a quick example.
Yeah.
There's fights. We have fights in my family all the time, right? We could fight on Saturday and be back together on that next Friday. You know, every birthday party, every celebration ended with either the police come in or somebody getting knocked out. It's like a regular thing. And my husband had decided, you know what, I'm not going this weekend. And that started being his thing. Like, he would just not go. He would stay home, hang out, do what he wanted, watch football. And then me and the kids would come back home, and I'm just upset, and there's all this family drama now. We have to work out. This is every week. And one moment I was like, he's over here chilling, feet on table, beer in hand, has no thought in the world about what I'm going through right now. And I really had to take a moment, and we talked about it, and he said, I'm not doing that anymore. Like, I'm not spending my time in that negative energy. Not that I don't like them. I just don't like that negative energy. So I decided to try it. And I started to use my kids as an excuse to not go places. I would be like, oh, he has a baseball game. She's cheerleading.
Yeah.
I'll pick up some volunteer opportunities. I mean, you name it. I came up with a reason why I couldn't go.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, I always missed the action. And I realized I'm totally okay with it. Not only did I miss the action, but I was able to do something enriching and fun with my kids or my family or my friends instead of having to have wine to figure out how to get this mess cleared up.
Right.
It was so invigorating on a Monday morning to not even have to give thought to what happened on Friday night. Like, we just moved on. It was nothing. So being able to practice that idea of setting boundaries and deciding what you want it to feel like, what you wanted your life to feel like on a regular basis, I really just started to sculpt my lifestyle around happiness and joy. What are the things that you do that bring you happiness and joy? Cheering for my son at a baseball game brings me happiness and joy. Cheering or coaching cheer with these young girls and teaching them to know, that's happiness and joy. Or just laying around with my husband talking about the 49ers brings me happiness and joy. Why would I do anything outside of that?
I think that's the reason that people do that because there's something about this idea of sunk cost and time when it comes to family, because you've had decades with these people and you've been digging for love and normalcy and that feeling that you think is supposed to come from family, and you just keep digging because you're like, I've been doing this for decades. I've got to be close. Maybe I just haven't hit it yet, but I've got to be close. And after a certain point, you just have to ask yourself whether you're just wasting your time in the wrong place when there is love and acceptance and everything that you're looking for somewhere else. Especially when you've got your own family. It's beautiful to be able to make that recognition and say, you know what, I don't have to dig for this somewhere else. It's a lot easier to find it with these people who actually want me here.
And I think that's it. Part of really digging into my upbringing was finding out that at the end of the day, my mom was looking for love. Right, she was looking for that love, that acceptance from her family.
Yeah,
she would go all out for people that would do her wrong. And I used to ask her about that, like, why would you do that for him? And he stole this from you, or he beat you up at the like, what is going on? And she eventually would tell me, you know, I'm lonely, or but I love him, or that's family. That's how it's supposed to be. So I think they're. Is a level of always looking for that love and always looking for that acceptance. And listen, I realize also that I'm not the only one that have experienced these types of things. So sure. Once you start loosening up your guard a little bit and having open conversation, and you're confident enough in yourself to acknowledge that some of these things have gone on, you realize, one, you're not the only one, and two, at the end of the day, people are looking for love, acceptance, praise, accolades, right?
Yeah.
That is what drives them, and they will accept abuse physically and emotionally to get it.
Oh, completely.
And I was like, no, that don't feel good, no. And once you start feeling good about the kind of love and life that you want, you don't accept anything less than that.
Yeah.
It just, why go backwards? Once you've had it, it's like a drug. Once you've had it and it's good, you don't go back to that. You don't back away from that. You fight for it if need be, but you definitely don't go back to the opposite. You just don't.
So where do you get your toolbox filled for any kind of coping mechanisms and whatnot for mental health issues? Because I imagine that's something that was kind of a tough thing to pick up and deal with, as far as the trauma that came from both the witnessing of what was essentially, at least even for a time being, the death of your mother, and then the sexual assault. How do you start recognizing that there's some mental health things to take care of? Because it doesn't sound like there was a lot of conversation around that.
Well, you know, Black culture is, you don't go to a therapist, you go to church.
Yeah.
The pastor was my uncle who assaulted me. So that wasn't going to happen.
Right.
I'm not going to church. So I really started relying on, the advice of those that were living the kind of life that I aspire to live. And I say this, like, I have older cousins on the other side of my family.
Yeah.
And no, on both sides, let me be honest, that are doing well, right? And I always thought, how are you doing this well coming from this kind of dysfunction? And having those conversations and how they got from that ugly place, or being able to identify the ugly place, to the life that they have. So asking questions and not being afraid of the answers or to do the work that I am advised to do.
Yeah.
And I can also say there was a breaking point, right? I got into a car accident in the Bay Area. I was on my way to work. I worked in Oakland, and I got into a car accident, but I was inches from falling off of a cliff. Like, my car was about to fall off a cliff. I think I fell asleep.
Oh, man.
It was awful. So I went to the doctor, and I told my primary physician, Dr. Johnson. He's absolutely amazing. And I was telling him everything that I was going through and why I haven't been able to sleep well and da-da-da. And he basically said, you have clinical depression. You have extreme clinical depression, severe clinical depression. And that did it for me, because I was like, no, I don't. I'm just tired. I got kids. I'm dealing with other people's kids. I'm married. I'm supposed to be going crazy. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
And he's like, nah, this is something different. So he let me know that, you know, there's these pills you can take for the rest of your life. And we talked through other methods of dealing with things. My blood pressure was high. It was a mess. And
yeah.
So I actually just turned to, I asked him, so what if I start working out? Like, what are my alternatives? I don't want to get hooked on drugs. We have drug addiction in my family.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to do that. So, you know, we just talked through some solutions. And I went back to some natural methods of dealing with things, which was workout and wellness. really getting in touch with my mind, body, and spirit. And conversation is healing for me. So whether it's me talking about my problems and letting someone be a sounding board for me, or letting other people talk about their problems, because most of the time they made me feel super sane.
Yeah.
And understanding that, you know, we carry so much on our shoulders with life that you're not, one, you're not alone. So whatever kind of isolation or insecurity, self-esteem issues I was having with some of the things that were going on in my life, I'm the only one that's dealing with crazy stuff. I think my husband had actually told me he had read the autopsy, and my mother had cocaine in her system when she passed. And that hit me in some kind of funny way, of course.
Yeah.
And then I, you know, had to deal with that. But instead of just dealing with it in isolation, having more conversation with other people in my family that may have known about it and just didn't want to talk to me about it. So now it's relieving because we can actually have a conversation about it and nobody has to feel like they can't say anything. Being very cognizant of the fact that people are holding secrets inside of them and afraid to talk about conversations became my healing. So conversation, that's really my healing, and dealing with complex issues. Because I started feeling like, if I can just, you know, say it, if I can just talk about it, it'll be okay.
Yeah.
Because it's not going to make or break me. It's the thing that is uncomfortable in whatever that subject is that's constraining my mind or my spirit or my, you know, making my shoulders rise up into my ears. And the doctor would say, anytime your shoulders start rising up in your ears, you know your blood pressure is probably rising. Okay. So let's talk about it. And I think my medicine just became, you know, taking care of myself. I work out regularly and having the tough conversation, because I recognize that anytime I'm holding on to something, it's causing me physical angst.
Yeah. Yeah. Holding those things in is so unhealthy. And I think that people underestimate the value of an honest conversation to save lives.
Even their own. It's like,
even their own,
you know, even my kids now, I'll say, you know, you can tell they're all, you know, pissed off about something and stuff.
Yeah.
Through the house and be like, hey, what's that about? Like, what's the heavy foot stomp and door slamming thing? Nothing. Oh, okay. That's why the freaking screw just popped out the door. Yeah. Oh, okay. So nothing. This is what we're going to do. And I am so annoying now, and we will talk it out until, well, I just felt like, you know, it's having those conversations where you say, I'm saying, I'm going to start this sentence. I want you to finish it. That made me feel like what? And I, you know, I have always this one that just will not answer the question.
Yeah.
Like, okay, well, you know, we'll have dinner when you decide to finish the sentence. And it's, listen, I'm not going to stop. So we're going to get to the bottom of it. And there are times when, yeah, you can't do anything about that. It made me feel like, okay, well, I'm your mom and that's what I'm going to do. So if that's what you're mad at, then, you know, go on over there and just be mad until you're done. But there are things that go on where, one, it's a misunderstanding, right? Someone said something that made you feel a certain kind of way. Maybe they didn't mean to. Okay, let's deal with that. Go apologize to your brother if that's not what you meant. But if you meant to call him a jerk, then okay, we just have to deal with him being a jerk. That's a whole different conversation. But it really comes down to having those conversations that are solutions-based to deal with any discomfort that people are having.
That's absolutely amazing. All of that, everything that you've been through, everything that's led you up to the point where you are now, And a level of help and decisions, conscious thought, action, bringing you to a place where you can apply those things to help the lives of your children. I mean, what kind of superheroes are they going to grow up to be?
They'll probably suck. I don't know. Look, I do the best I can, but... And that's the other thing, you know, everybody has their own, they make their own decisions. You teach them everything that you can. Even my mom, even at her worst, my mom and my dad. I learned to, this is the ultimate lesson I learned, is not to be judgmental, right?
Yeah.
You never know what's going on in other people's relationships. So my parents have been divorced as long as I can remember. All this melee happened in my life. My dad didn't know nothing about it because he was on drugs in the Bay Area somewhere. And I mean, I came home from college one time on a weekend, just popped in on my mom. Guess who was there? My dad. They were having the time of their life. I was like, what is going on? This is not okay. She was like, I never told you I didn't like him no more. I was like, I'm out of here. I gotta go. You can never judge other people's relationships based on what you might think about them. You just can't. And that was the shock of my entire life. She's like, yeah, he came over, took me shopping, blah, blah, blah. What? Oh, I'm out of here. Yeah. I don't even know I don't even know how to process this right now. I don't know how to process. I'm leaving. I can't do this. I'm too young for this. It's gross. I'm going to throw it in my mouth. So with that, you know, you learn, you can't judge other people's relationships either. So I just really try to have good relationships and have good conversation, good quality conversation. Listen, I ain't got time to be pussyfooting around with, hey, how you doing? How's the weather? Like, no, let's get down to it.
Yeah.
What's really going on? Because that's where the meat and potatoes of it is. And I just happened to enjoy that, probably because I was so afraid of that growing up. Like, I'm scared to ask why my mom is in jail.
Yeah.
But once I'm old enough to be okay with whatever that is, I'm okay having that conversation. And if I can talk about that, good Lord, we can talk about anything.
Well, thanks for talking to me.
Listen, I appreciate the laugh. It's my favorite thing to do. It's a healer. And anytime I can have an open conversation like this with you or anyone, I'm happy to, because I think it gives us an opportunity to just see things from a different perspective. And even in situations like this that we're going through as our country, if we just take the time to have the conversation about how people are feeling or what's happening to make a person feel that way, and what am I doing to either contribute or improve how they're feeling, you know, we all make choices in how we play a role in each other's lives and in the big picture. And if you care about what that role is, you know, you take the time to have a conversation about it and do the work.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't have said that better. Thank you.
That's all I got. I don't know. Oh, my God. That's all I got. But no, I appreciate the opportunity to, you know, chat with you and hope the audience, you know, you learn nothing else. It's just don't be afraid to put on your big girl or big boy panties and have those tough conversations. They'll really take you to a place you probably never expected.
How do you hear that conversation and not just get the most inspired you've ever been to get out there, spread your wings, and try? The sky's the limit, my friends, and Tanya McKenzie is definitely one of the bright spots in it. And if you want to get some more Tanya in your life, and I know that you do, it's very easy. You just go to TanyaMcKenzie.com. Also, there is a link in the feed below to the website and a place where you can get the book. Request it if the bookstore that you love doesn't have it, because it is out there, it's available, and it's amazing. Let's put this thing on the bestseller list. Can we do that? I think we can do that. But until next week, don't kill yourselves out there.